Welcome to a very special presentation of the novel A Really Good Day by James Hosek. On its surface, it's a story about a remarkable round of golf. But if you're not a golfer, if you quickly change the channel, if you accidentally come upon a tournament on TV, I encourage you to listen anyway. It's a story about family and friendship. It's a story about redemption and second chances. It's a story about promises made and promises kept. It's a story about once-in-a-lifetime experiences. But most of all, it is one man's love letter to his family. That man was my brother, the author, James Hosek. Aside from being an amazing veterinarian, woodworker, gardener, husband, father, brother, son, and friend, he was a writer. Writers are often told to write what they know. And in this, his first book, he did that in more ways than I can count. It will make you laugh. It will make you cry. And it will make you stand up and cheer. So sit back and enjoy as Jim takes you on a fun, entertaining journey through 18 holes of golf and one man's really good day. Chapter 19, 14th hole. Another long par 5 awaited Andrew Patterson. This one was uphill. There was some water that came into play on the second shot, but this would be an easy par. There was plenty of room for Hanover to make a mistake, and Andrew was beginning to wonder how long he would have to wait before he would take the lead. If he could birdie this one, he'd definitely at least tie the lucky jerk. Still, there were 5 holes to play. Andrew was playing better than he expected. If he could keep it up, he'd certainly have played his personal best. But beating his own score wasn't good enough. He needed to win. Waiting a year for his next chance was unacceptable with victory so close. Hanover had been ranked last out of all the players, and here he was, head-to-head with number 1, and winning. Inconceivable. Eric handed Andrew his driver and then stepped back behind the tee. Andrew set up his ball and eyed a spot in the middle of the fairway. No need to hold back, but no need to go wild either. He set up and blasted the ball straight out. Both sides of the fairway were lined with spectators, and they started applauding before the ball's first bounce on the fairway. It rolled up near the 250-yard marker. Not bad for an uphill shot, Andrew thought. His drive had gone 300 yards straight down the middle. Not bad at all. He pulled up his tee and stepped back, handing the club to Eric. Hanover seemed in a good mood as he stepped up to the tee. He seemed amazed by the sea of people on each side. "I hope I don't hit anyone," he said to the amusement of those close by. He set up his ball and lined up his shot. In reality, Scott hadn't been joking with his last comment. He wondered how the pros made the people disappear in their minds. He remembered one guy who got hit by one of Tiger Woods' rare errant shots. The fan was okay and even ended up with an autographed hat from the golfer. Scott didn't think anyone here would be happy with a signed cap. He hoped for a par here. It was a little longer than the first hole he had played, and it was uphill instead of downhill. He had always liked par fives. You could have 2 so-so shots as long as you had 1 good one to get on the green. Even if you got on with 4 shots, a good putt could always save par. He remembered a par 5 he had played several years ago where his 3rd shot had taken him 4 or 5 yards to the right of the green on the downslope of a hill. He then proceeded to chip the ball up over the hill and drained it right into the hole for a birdie. Yep, he liked par 5s. He stared at Patterson's drive in the middle of the fairway. The guy was consistent and good. Scott realized that Patterson had a pretty good chance of beating him when all was said and done, but he didn't have to make it easy for him. One thing Patterson couldn't do, even if he ended with a lower score, was take away this day. He'd always remember his hole-in-one, his never-ending series of miraculous shots, the bee on the last hole, and his wife cheering him on. He performed his pre-drive ritual, complete with two practice swings, then stepped up to the ball. The crowd observed a considerate silence. Carl Bateman watched as Hanover started his backswing. Bateman squirmed in his seat, feeling a sudden sense of discomfort. As he did, his foot hit the gas pedal of the golf cart. The gas engine throttled to life, and the tanned vehicle shot forward a few feet before Carl could get his foot back on the brake. The distraction was too late for Hanover to change his swing. Scott heard the noise, but his body wanted to swing, and he couldn't stop. The club head skirted over the top of the ball, knocked it off the tee, and sent it rolling 5 yards closer to the hole. He stared at the ball, then slowly raised his head, his eyes finding the offending golf cart among the onlookers on the right side of the fairway near the tee. People near Bateman's cart started backing up. Coming towards them was a very angry man with a golf club in one hand. Ball dropped Scott's bag with a clatter of clubs and caught up to Scott, grabbing him by the shoulders. Scott tried to shrug him off, then stopped. Even from 15 yards away, he could see the fright in Carl Bateman's eyes. The man was terrified, and his jaw was working to either spew out an apology or a denial that it was his fault. "Not worth it," Paul muttered. "Let him hit again," shouted a voice from the crowd. It was joined by a groundswell of support for the do-over. Scott turned around and started walking back. Andrew Patterson was talking to the official at the tee. Scott looked into the red-jacketed man's face. The official seemed sympathetic, but the shaking of his head confirmed to Scott that the shot would stand. Scott knew it would, but God, it sure sucked. "Can't let distractions get to you. Should have stopped that swing," Patterson said. Paul stepped quickly in front of Scott and stared into the other golfer's eyes. He spoke but directed his comments to the official while retaining his gaze on Patterson. "Isn't there a penalty for commenting on the other golfer's swing?" he asked. Patterson's expression morphed into one of terror, and he turned to the official. "There is, but," he considered, "Mr. Patterson's comment doesn't qualify." Paul nodded in silent acceptance, but he was confident that Patterson had gotten the message. You don't jump on another player's misfortune. Paul handed Scott his 3-wood, and they walked up to his ball. Boos were heard coming from the crowd, mostly directed at Carl Bateman, but some went Andrew's way. Jason Bernard was stunned in his booth. He talked privately with Freddy. "Can't he take the shot over if someone distracts him like that?"
"No way. It's up to the golfer to stop his swing if something prevents him from keeping his concentration."
"So what? He hits it from where it landed?"
"That's it."
"I thought he was going to wrap that club around that idiot in the cart's neck."
"Me too."
"I gotta get back on," Jason said. He switched over to the live feed. "That just goes to show how much concentration is required to compete in this game at this level. The man in the golf cart, Carl Bateman, must feel awful. And Andrew Patterson can't be feeling that great either. If he does win by only one stroke, he's got to wonder if he came about that stroke fairly. Hanover is setting up for his second shot. He has 545 yards left."
"That jerk," whispered Sarah.
"Calm down, it's done," Sally whispered back.
"He should get to do it over."
"Then golfers would be claiming all sorts of things distracted them," Gina added.
"But this was so obvious," complained Sarah.
"Just relax," Sally warned.
You don't want to speed things along, if you know what I mean.
I will, she promised. She took some deep breaths, but shook her head slowly. It just wasn't fair.
Foot slip? Asked Harold Frisk.
What? Asked Bakeman, distracted from his current state of panic.
I'd be up there apologizing after he takes his next swing.
What? No, best to leave it be.
Perhaps for you, but this is on television. 8 million homes and growing by the minute. You could end up being the schlub of the year, or a decent guy who made a mistake.
He should have stopped his swing. No penalty for that.
He's just an amateur. He doesn't have the discipline that Tiger Woods has. Once he starts, he's got to go. Apologize. You're making the tournament look bad.
He wants to hurt me.
He'll want to hurt you less after you prove to him it was an accident and not intentional.
All right, I'll apologize. After he swings, I'll drive over there.
Bateman, Frisk said, with the tone one would say for a dog that just peed on the carpet.
Yes,
whined Carl.
Walk over there.
Right, muttered Carl.
The silence that befell the crowd as Scott set up for his second shot was unnaturally quiet. There weren't even any stray coughs or sneezes. It's only one stroke, Scott told himself. You're on in four and a one putt for par. He turned his head to look down the fairway. He could see Patterson's well-hit drive teasing him from the middle. Patterson could be on in two with a decent fairway shot. Scott had thought about using his driver off the grass to try and get some extra yardage, but he knew he wasn't used to that sort of lie with the club and could quite easily top the ball again. He wouldn't get as many yards with the three-wood, but in the end he'd still get there. He set up his club and started to take a practice swing when the quiet just got to him. He stopped, looked back at the tee, and nodded his head slightly.
Well, at least I can say one thing about that shot, he said loudly, so even those in the back could hear.
It's closer to the hole.
The joke broke the tension like a 200-pound kid doing a cannonball into a swimming hole. The crowd laughed and Scott joined in. Carl Bateman remained silent but tried to smile, Scott noticed. After a moment, the crowd settled down into its normal murmurs and rustles.
That's better, Scott said. It was just a little too quiet there for a minute.
Another chuckle, and he settled back to hit the ball. He skipped his practice swings, set his club and feet, and swung at the patch of turf where the ball lay. It soared out. He was aimed a little to the right so that when the ball bounced and rolled, it ended up 2 yards from the feet of the people, 230 yards down the fairway. But it was a good shot. 350 yards to go. The applause was genuine, and the people seemed grateful that he had been able to salvage a decent second shot.
Mr. Hanover? Said a quivery voice.
Scott turned to see Carl Bateman standing in front of him. He looked at the man and slowly lowered his golf club.
I am truly sorry about what happened there. My foot slipped and knocked the accelerator. I was clumsy and feel awful about costing you a stroke.
Scott took in the man's words and measured their sincerity. He put himself in Bateman's place and tried to imagine how the man felt.
Please let me know if there's anything I or the tournament can do for you. I wish I could make it up to you, but I don't think that's possible.
No, Mr. Bateman, it isn't, Scott answered.
He took the man's outstretched hand and shook it. But I do accept your apology, and I do realize that distractions are part of the game. I apologize for approaching your cart in a less-than-friendly manner. It was poor sportsmanship on my part.
Carl seemed taken aback by Scott's apology. He decided to leave the exchange at that.
As he turned to leave, he noted the camera woman behind the tee, who had been filming the exchange and then continued back to his cart.
Very nice, commented Frisk. Saw the whole thing on TV. Now get this thing down the fairway.
Well, that was a spot of bad luck, Tim Carousel said as he sipped his tea from a styrofoam cup. He raised his eyebrows, pleasantly surprised at the taste. That should give Patterson at least a tie for the lead, added Karen.
Yes, but he seemed rather a poor sport about the whole thing, even though it wasn't his fault.
He was stunned, April suggested. Could have been him it happened to, she added.
I suppose so, said Carousel. I'm sure after another couple of holes the whole thing will be quite forgotten.
Exactly, Karen said. Carousel looked at his tea in one hand and the emptiness of his other, and realized what was missing. Any chance for a biscuit? Scott was up as he was still furthest from the hole. Paul handed him the 5-wood this time. Just knock it 200 yards closer, he advised.
No problem.
As Scott approached the ball, he glanced at the people standing just a couple of yards away and stopped. His eyes widened, and he walked up to two of the men. Jerry, Pete, how'd you guys do?
Pete raised his hand.
Last.
Jerry lifted his.
Second to last.
Well, I'm not done yet, Scott said. They all laughed.
Don't let that fancy pants beat you, Jerry said.
Yeah, if he wins, everyone's going to start dressing like him, and I won't be able to stomach going to the golf course anymore.
Well, listen, catch up with me afterward. I'll buy you guys a drink.
You're on, said Pete.
It's the least you can do.
We're rooting for you.
Thanks. He stepped back and eyed his ball and picked out the direction he wanted to aim. He took a couple of practice swings this time, then stepped up to the ball. The backswing felt great, and the ball sailed up off the grass. It ended up a little more left than he planned, and he cringed as the line of onlookers flowed back from the edge of the fairway as his ball rolled a yard or so into the rough. He was maybe 120 yards from the hole now. The rough wouldn't be too bad. Prior to today, he had had a lot of experience with the rough.
Nice shot, Paul said. You're on in 4, buddy.
Hopefully. Paul eyed him with misapprehension. Then Scott remembered his promise.
Right, on in 4, he echoed.
He handed the club to Paul, and they walked up to near where Andrew would hit his second shot. Andrew knew he was quite capable of putting the ball on the green from 250 yards out half the time. From 200 yards out, that number became 95% of the time. With Hanover's topped shot on the tee, he was willing to go for it today. He'd lose some accuracy, but the thought of a birdie was exciting. He handed the 4-iron that Eric had produced according to Andrew's club list back to the caddy and said, 2-iron. Eric checked the bag and sure enough there was a 2-iron. He hadn't seen it before and quickly counted the clubs again to make sure Patterson hadn't played this far with an illegal club count. He had counted when they started and was sure they hadn't. Most golfers had a standard set of 3 woods, 8 irons, sandwich, putter, and perhaps a loft wedge or maybe a 7-wood. Eric looked in Patterson's bag and realized he wasn't carrying a sand wedge. He was confident, if not cocky, thought Eric. Patterson twirled the club head in front of his face for a moment. He rarely used the 2-iron and almost didn't put it in the bag this morning. It wasn't on his club list, but he had room for one more and had the foresight to select this one. The 2-iron had its uses, and this was one. He took a couple of easy swings with the club, grazing the top of the grass, getting used to the shaft length and the weight compared to his other irons. With silence besetting the crowd, he stepped up to hit his ball. The sound it made was quite different from that of a wood, or even another iron. The virtual flatness of the face assured no spin, and the ball rocketed low over the fairway, landing about 100 yards from the hole, but bouncing with such speed that it continued to roll until it was just short of the fringe of the green. That, he thought, was good enough to get me a birdie. Scott let out the breath he was holding. That was a grass burner.
Must have been a 2-iron, Paul said. I used to have one. Oh yeah, what happened to it? You know that water hazard on 12 at Highland Woods?
Yeah, said Scott.
Then he realized what Paul was saying.
Oh.
Yeah, oh, Paul repeated. The two continued their walk down the fairway.
It's a great day to be golfing, Scott, said Paul.
Scott sniffed the air and stretched his neck to feel the breeze.
It's a really good day, Paul.
Hanover is going down now, said Lucy Pendle to herself. Lewis Filtry heard the comment.
It only takes one really bad shot to ruin a player's momentum, he added.
This guy's not playing on momentum. It's all dumb luck, Lucy added.
Well, if he loses, that ball probably won't be worth the trouble those guys went to get it.
Lucy turned and looked at the cameraman like he had just landed from another planet.
What are you talking about, Filtry?
On 8. Some guys in scuba equipment went after Hanover's water ball. I think they found it. They certainly seemed happy.
Guys with scuba equipment?
Yeah, I told Ellie Burke about it. Oh, and that woman who I bumped into at the 11th tee. She seemed interested.
You mean Patterson's agent?
Is that who she is?
She came up to me and insisted I get more one-on-one interviews with the guy.
Well, it was a pretty weird thing seeing them go to all that trouble for a ball.
That water must be freezing.
You think they were fans? Lucy asked.
Well, they could have been with the tournament.
They had a golf cart and trailer, added Lewis.
Lucy digested this information. Something was going on. A fan wouldn't go through the trouble of getting scuba equipment. They'd just jump in the water, freezing or not.
It must have been the tournament officials that wanted it. But why?
She could think of only one reason that made sense.
They suspected Hanover was using spiked balls.
Holy cow! If he was, this would blow the tournament wide open and turn Scott Hanover into another Eric Gunther.
The best part would be if Lucy could break the story.
Unfortunately, stuck here, she was not in a position to track down who the scuba divers were and what they had found. She pulled out her cell phone and dialed.
Keith, she asked when the other line was answered.
Lucy, honey, I'm sorry. Frisk overruled me, the old windbag,
answered Keith Kelly.
Forget about that. I may have something else here.
What?
The tournament officials may believe Hanover is using juiced-up balls. It appears as if they've quietly retrieved one that he hit into a water hazard earlier. I think they're having it analyzed.
You think he's a cheat?
How else could he be doing so well? Lucy asked.
It makes sense,
Keith said, agreeing with her.
I can't get away to check it out.
It's okay, I'm here at the clubhouse. I'll ask some questions.
Great, Lucy said. Don't tell Jason.
Mum's the word.
Kenny Chase carried the small white envelope containing the CD out with him to his blazer. Step one was done. The technician had even taken the x-rays at several exposures. Kenny had looked at them on the computer screen of their digital systems. It appeared to be a normal ball, but to be sure, he needed to get inside. Fortunately, he only needed to go west one stoplight before he found what he needed. He pulled into the Dominick's grocery store lot. The store was sure to have a decent meat department, and, if he was lucky, a butcher on the premises. The duck logo ball was in his pants pocket. His red jacket drew a few looks, but he barreled through the aisles to get to the back of the store. He quickly found the open freezer case near the tank of live lobsters. A man, wearing a blood-stained apron over white work clothes, similarly stained, was sliding a package of butterfly pork chops into the display area.
"Can I help you?" he asked. "Pork chops are excellent today."
"I have an unusual request," started Kenny.
"I've been doing this for 22 years, the butcher said. "I've pretty much seen it all. I've even had people walk out of here with a 2-liter bottle of blood."
Kenny pulled the golf ball from his pocket and asked,
Can you cut this in half for me?
The butcher raised his eyebrows.
I take it back.
He reached over and took the golf ball.
I'd ask you why, but I really don't want to know.
He looked at the lack of other customers at the counter and smiled.
I'll see what I can do.
The butcher pushed through the swinging doors separating the meat preparation area from the display cases. Kenny could see him holding up the ball and discussing the problem with another butcher. Kenny assumed they would just bandsaw the ball in half. All butchers used the powerful saws to cut through frozen slabs of meat. Oddly, though, the second man pulled a large cleaver from a hook on the wall and hefted it in his hands a few times. He placed the ball on a butcher block table in the center of a piece of meat, which kept it from rolling off the table. With all the drama of a circus performer, he waved the knife slowly in the air above the ball, eyeing the target with care, and suddenly raised it high above his head and slammed the knife into the ball. Kenny had expected the blade to hit the ball off center, sending it flying in one direction and the knife slipping in the other, perhaps hurting one of the men. By some miracle, the cleaver had found the exact center of the ball, and the two halves were spread neatly on top of the meat. The first butcher gathered them up, rinsed them in a sink, then dried them on his blood-stained apron as he walked back out to the front. He placed the two pieces on a small sheet of butcher paper, wrapped them up, and taped it closed. Then he handed it to Kenny. Kenny took the package, stunned at the display he had just witnessed.
"How much?" he murmured.
"No charge," the butcher said, chuckling. "Frankie loves a challenge and a chance to show off."
"Thanks. Are you sure you don't want to know what it's for?"
The man shook his head, smiled, and waved goodbye as he disappeared into the back again. Kenny placed the small package in his pants and headed out of the store. He was tempted to open the package right now, but decided to wait to look at the ball more closely when he got back. He'd already taken some basic measurements. The orb was 1 11/16 in diameter. Its weight was 1.6 ounces, on the scale at the veterinary clinic they reserved for weighing tiny animals. Kenny had seen many doped balls in the past. He knew what to look for, and part of him hoped that Hanover was clean. Kenny wondered if it even mattered now. For all he knew, Patterson was in the lead and Hanover had descended the rankings out of contention. He debated calling in, but figured he'd find out how things were going when he got back. He hopped back into the Blazer and pulled out onto 159th Street. He roared along the left turn lane, passing the stopped cars to their irritated honks. The state cop who waved him down saw the Niagara logo on the side and nodded Kenny through after checking in on his radio. Kenny again drove in the left lane. The police were slowly untangling the traffic mess, having cars turn around and head back out along Central Avenue. They halted this process to let Kenny get back into the golf course parking lot. After he pulled in, he noted the place seemed dead quiet. The large mass of people by the clubhouse were silently watching the event play out on the television monitors scattered around. Even more strange was the helicopter parked on the driving range. Kenny thought it was certainly turning out to be a day he would always remember. Scott took his pitching wedge from Paul and used it to draw a line from the flagstick to his ball, then set his feet parallel to that line in his usual routine. A few shouts of encouragement greeted him from the crowd. He looked at the people and saw Sarah standing about 15 yards away, smiling and absently rubbing her bulging stomach in smooth circles. "Baby must be kicking," he thought. The other two women flanked her. Both had expressions far too serious for the event. He looked at the ball and took a moment to pray for a straight shot. On the few occasions he had skipped Sunday services to play golf with friends from out of town, Scott had justified his playing hooky by pointing out to Sarah that he usually ended up praying much more on the golf course than he ever did in church. And what better place to worship God than in the setting of nature?
carved into 18 well-designed and manicured holes. He took his two practice swings, confident the rhythm was right, and stepped close to the ball. The crowd could have been singing the Hallelujah chorus, and he wouldn't have been fazed right then. He swung at the ball, and it rose into the air as planned, and landed just a few inches to the right of the pin. But unfortunately, it kept rolling until it was almost touching the back fringe of the green. No amazing backspin this time. "Nice and straight," Paul said. "Just a little too much Wheaties this morning," added Scott. "But you're on in four. You can sink that putt, buddy." "You bet," agreed Scott. And they walked up the course to the green. The crowd filled in behind them. Despite the demands for the limited number of good viewing spots to watch the proceedings, Scott noticed that Carl Bateman and his passenger always had a place reserved as they moved to the next shot. And the red-jacketed woman who escorted Sarah and her new friends made sure they could always see what was happening. He hadn't seen Jake Fisher for a while, but Ellie was there at almost every shot, usually inconspicuous, capturing the event for the television audience and for posterity. Patterson's ball was slightly further from the hole than Scott's, and he stopped behind it, eyeing the green, nodding in confirmation at times as he judged the path of his putt. "Think he'll eagle?" Scott asked. "No," answered Paul. "Despite his skill, he's too conservative. He's too afraid to leave the ball short. I've noticed that." Paul left unsaid the fact that even if Patterson birdied and Scott parred, the two would be tied. If Scott bogeyed, Patterson would hold a one-stroke lead, all because of an idiot with a heavy foot. Scott walked around to the back of the green and marked his ball and checked it over for any damage. He cleaned off a bit of mud and slipped it into his pocket, waiting for Patterson to putt. Andrew stood with his gold-plated, jade-headed putter, ready to strike the ball. He refused to think the ball would go in. He wanted to be near the hole and get his birdie. His two-iron gamble had paid off, and now he wanted a safe shot to completely eliminate Hanover's lead and hopefully grab it for himself. He struck the putt, and the ball rolled unerringly for the hole, and then broke a little to the left before stopping 10 inches away. The crowd reacted with a collective awe and then applause. Andrew, smiling contently, walked over to mark his own ball while Scott went to take his first putt. Scott and Paul eyed the green and decided to play it a little to the left. Scott set his stroke with three practice swings and stepped up to the ball. How could Patterson just walk up and hit it? The guy must practice putting in his bedroom for an hour every night before he went to bed. He drew the putter back and hit the ball. It rolled a little to the left, then broke back toward the hole and stopped about 5 inches short. Scott slumped in place, and the crowd applauded his efforts nonetheless. "Two strokes," he muttered. "You'll get them back," Paul said. Scott chuckled. "You'll have to make a mistake at some point, and I don't think he will." "He can't control everything," Paul added. "Maybe." Scott looked at Patterson, who nodded for Scott to finish the hole. Scott tapped in his ball and held it up to the cheers of the crowd. Andrew shook his head. "The guy bogeys, and still the crowd thinks he's great." Andrew placed his ball in front of his coin, slid the golden dollar out, and palmed it straight to his pocket. He smiled as he hit the ball with an almost nonchalant air. It rolled straight into the middle of the hole with no doubt as to him scoring the birdie. The crowd cheered him as well, perhaps with slightly more vigor than they had for Hanover. After all, Andrew was the better golfer.
"What a setback for Hanover," Jason Bernard announced. "After 13 holes of nothing over par, he turns in his first bogey of the day, and all because of an unfortunate distraction from the crowd. He's got to be disappointed with that. Let's get some reaction from Lucy Pendle on the course."
Lewis flashed Lucy the thumbs up to let her know they were now on the air. Lucy's expression turned into a slight smile. Next to her stood Scott Hanover. "Tough break on that hole, Scott." "It's part of the game," Scott said. "Still, without the flub shot, at worst you would be tied with Patterson at this point." "Well, Lucy, in this game I never assume anything is going to happen. I came out here today hoping not to embarrass myself, and I think I've succeeded. Andrew Patterson is statistically and literally the better golfer. I've had a great run of holes, the best in my life. If it's over, so be it. If he does win today, the better golfer will have claimed the title." "That's a pretty generous and gracious attitude, Scott, and very sportsmanlike." Lucy decided to ask one more question. "There is a rumor that the tournament is investigating your equipment, specifically your balls. They think you may be using spiked balls to get some extra distance. Any comment?" Confusion clouded Scott's face. What was she talking about? "The officials checked my equipment at the turn. Everything checked out okay." "So you're denying that your balls are juiced up?" Lucy asked. Suddenly, an angry voice shouted in her earpiece.
"What are you doing, Pendle?"
Jason Bernard shouted from the control room. Lucy ignored the question. "You saw me play that last hole," Scott answered. "Did it look like I was cheating?" "Well, good luck. I'm sure it will turn out fine." Lucy turned to face the camera directly. "We'll bring you the results of the official tests on Scott Hanover's golf balls as soon as we have them. Back to you, Jason." Jason gathered himself quickly as his own image appeared on the monitors. What was Lucy trying to pull? Was she still mad about Jason getting the commentary position? "I'm sure we'll find that Scott Hanover's equipment is within regulations," Jason said. "That aside, what a terrific guy Scott Hanover has proven to be. He never had any idea he would be in contention in this tournament, let alone have a 3-stroke lead at one time, and set a 9-hole record. But even if Patterson maintains his lead, Scott Hanover will leave today with something more valuable than a win or a spot in the Pro-Am tournament. He'll have the admiration and best wishes of all those watching this incredible match today. And let me point out that there has been no official word from the tournament that they think Scott is using spiked balls. Probably just a rumor from the crowd." Bob signaled for the technicians to go to commercial. "Interesting turn of events, Jason," he said. "I can't believe Lucy would throw that out to Scott like that. Have you heard anything about what she's talking about?" "Not a word," Bob answered. "I can't help but feel sorry for Hanover. It'll be almost impossible to regain the lead. Patterson is on a roll. 5 birdies in a row. Hanover never even came close to a streak like that." "It's not over till it's over. We're picking up 10 more affiliates after this next commercial break, by the way." "Wow," Jason said. Kenny Chase stared at the monitor that had just flashed to a Miller Lite commercial. How did that reporter find out they were checking out Hanover's golf balls? Bateman had wanted to keep this quiet. Now it had gone out to millions of viewers. He pulled the paper-wrapped ball halves from his pocket. He peeled off the short piece of masking tape and hesitantly unfolded the paper. What if Scott Hanover was using a doped ball? He'd be pulled from the tournament and Patterson would finish the round alone and walk away with the prize. Kenny didn't really care which one of them won, but he didn't want Patterson to win by default. He wrapped the ball up again without examining it. Patterson was winning. If he kept the lead, it didn't matter what kind of balls Hanover was using. Better to wait and see how things played out. If Hanover lost, there was really no strong reason to check it out. If he were winning by 17, he'd check the ball out. Definitely better to wait. "You know," Joe Culkin said, "I wouldn't mind paying off my bet to Patterson if he won in a good match. But to take the lead because of that idiot in the cart." Ted Ling nodded in agreement.
Still four holes, Joe. Two long par fours, a medium four, and that par three by the pond. Plenty of places for something to happen.
I just wish Patterson had to sweat it out a little longer.
It could work in your favor. Too much confidence can be a downfall as well.
Let's hope you're right.
Sarah stood while the crowd flowed around them. Breathe, Sally reminded her. Sarah started her patterned breathing, while Gina checked her watch. 11 minutes. They're getting a little closer. Still too far apart, Sarah gasped as she stiffened against the pain. Plenty of time. Sally looked for a bench but couldn't see one. Their escort asked if there was anything she could do. Sally shook her head. After another 30 seconds, Sarah straightened up and took a few deep breaths. Okay, I'm ready, she said. Are you sure? Gina asked. Sarah's look answered her question, and they walked through the trees to the next tee.
Hanover is cheating? April Weinstein asked, as she took in Lucy Pendle's interview.
A cameraman told me that a scuba diver had gone after a ball in the water hazard on the 8th hole.
It must have been Hanover's, Karen explained.
Well, unless Hanover gets the lead back, it really doesn't matter, April realized.
Hanover's not playing Callaway balls, is he?
Tim Carousel asked.
I doubt it, Karen answered.
Be a shame if he was, Carousel said.
We'd better head out to the course, Karen replied.
Yes, April agreed. She turned to Tim Carousel. You can meet our boy and wish him luck on the last couple of holes. Nothing like a little encouragement to send him along.
I assume we'll drive,
drawled Carousel.
April looked at Karen inquisitively.
Karen answered her stare. The tournament is only allowing officials to be out in carts, but it's a very short walk. I was out that way this morning.
Oh, well, if we must, we must, Carousel said, consenting.
The executive stood, finished his tea, and the women followed him as he headed for the door.
Whatever happened to that biscuit? He asked.
Karen shrugged. Carousel shook it off and led the way.
April mouthed to her. Biscuit?
Karen shrugged again, and they were off.
Thank you for listening to A Really Good Day, a novel by James Hosek, narrated by Rich Hosek. If you're interested in purchasing a hardcover edition of this story for yourself or a golfer in your life, visit jimbooks.myshopify.com. You'll get free shipping in the United States. You'll also get the complete audiobook and ebook editions with your purchase. And make sure to subscribe to the mailing list for updates about the upcoming release of his Doctor at Mystery series, Cozy Mysteries about a crime-solving veterinarian. Thanks again, and all the very best.